672-5763. Now, your host for Public Pulse, Floyd Whiting.
And welcome to Public Pulse. I'm Floyd Whiting. It is Monday, September 30th, and we are in Wyoming's Emerald City. This morning, I'm joined by Sheridan Memorial Hospital primary care doctor, Christopher Schamber, and occupational therapist, Rachel Fields. Good morning, Doc. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Floyd.
Rachel, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much.
Now, how are things going on down at the primary care clinic?
It's going well down at the primary care clinic. We're seeing lots of patients have great access. You can get seen the same day if you need to. It's going really well.
Now, you and I have been talking about the primary care clinic since you opened it up. How long have you been in operation down there?
Just over 2 years.
Just over 2 years.
Yeah.
Now, and what was the intention behind taking these services from the hospital down to downtown Sheridan?
Really, it was to expand our primary care workforce to include a large presence of family medicine in the community, which has not been really well established, especially through the hospital in the past.
And that's really kind of the old-fashioned doctor, isn't it?
That is the old-fashioned doctor, caring for people from birth to death.
From cradle to the grave.
That's right.
Now, within your amount of time down there, have you gotten to know a lot of new families? I mean, have you seen it kind of bring people together closer to their doctors?
I would say so for sure. It's definitely been a good experience being sort of offsite from the main hospital because it serves as a different hub, so to speak, of medicine downtown. People can come in and get their blood drawn, go and get lunch, you know, at the Pony or the Flagstaff Cafe, come in for an appointment afterwards. They're bringing their whole families in now. So it's really a good experience.
And so the intention has been met.
Absolutely. And still working on that, expanding that, still ever expanding that family medicine presence to make it exactly what you described, that old fashioned doc.
Doc, how would you say that expansion is going? And what are the steps that you guys are taking to do that?
I think it's going well. Whenever you start a new clinic, bring on new providers, it takes time. And so we knew that time, that time commitment would exist, and just taking the steps and putting ourselves out there and various marketing campaigns, being on here with Dr. Rinker a couple of years ago when she first came into the community. And I would say it's going as expected.
Now, when it comes to individuals up at the hospital, specialists, and we all desperately need our specialists. Have you gotten feedback from your doctors that are coming in, just like your patients? Are they saying, you know, this is exactly what I was looking for? This has got that old-fashioned feel to it where I feel like I'm really making an impact on the community. And what's the feedback from docs been like?
The feedback has been great. You know, we add access. And when we started this clinic, you know, our access with my clinic before was difficult because we were all working in the hospital. We were working in the clinic. And so adding a new point of access that just has a different feel to it has been a much needed commitment, you know, from the community of providers, and docs can have that additional provider to refer to from a primary care perspective.
Well, I can tell you from my own experiences, it is so nice to have one individual to sit down and know what's going on with me before I bring up the new problem. Now, I realize that a lot of doctors can look at records and things like that, but I have been part of various institutions where it's a different doctor all the time. And you feel like you got to tell the same story to a different person every time you go in. And I'll admit, that's a roadblock for me. It's a bit of a hurdle. You know, I can get through this. This pain ain't going to last that long. I don't have to go down there and tell the same story to a different person that I'm only going to see once all over again. It's nice having an individual where you can walk in, have the same, a different conversation each time. And they know now we're going to do this because of this, this, and that. You get that a lot from individuals. I mean, was that part of the intention? So I had that one contact.
Absolutely. I would say it's no different than what we had done at internal medicine. It's just adding that extra component of again, the cradle to the grave, adding that the younger people to that population as well. But absolutely what you described is the ideal situation for any primary care doctor. Again, whether we're talking about family medicine, pediatrics, or internal medicine, it makes care easier, more efficient, better for the patient and the provider.
On that, have you noticed more people coming to the hospital more frequently because of that? Because that hurdle's been removed, where they're like, well, I don't mind going down and seeing Doc Schamber. That's where I'm going. I know I'm going to talk to him, so I'm almost excited to go down and do it. Have you noticed more people coming in because, or more frequently, I guess I should say?
Yeah, I think that happens as a function of a good primary care service when you have enough people to fill the need. And I think we're getting to that point. And you have patients that won't see anybody else, and now they can. Before, you know, when I first started, we just didn't have enough docs in the community to fill that primary care need. And they would see whoever they could see at any given time. And now they have the opportunity to say, no, I just want to see Dr. Schamber. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do that. And I'll see him tomorrow or the next week, not 3 months down the road.
Yeah. See, and I feel like that's a big part of it, especially for individuals that are, you know, a little older, a little more old fashioned, where it's like, I can live through this. I'll be fine. This pain in my shoulder, even though it's intense, will eventually go away. I don't need to go to a new doctor. But if you've got that family doc, I think it just makes it easier. Maybe even seeing them on the road. Hey, this is hurting again. Okay, come see me next Tuesday or whatever. Just makes things more personable. Are you seeing a lot of colds and flus as of yet? I mean, we're just on the cusp of that season.
Yeah, not so much flu, but colds in general. Still seeing COVID, which is fairly consistent, though not like it was before. I would say since the pandemic, there hasn't been as much of an up and down during the quote unquote flu season as we would have seen before. There's been, it seems like, a rather steady trickle of colds and flus and different bugs around, even through the spring and summer and fall months.
Okay. Do you foresee, and I realize this is going to take a lot of conjecture, but do you foresee a COVID season in the future?
I'm sure there will be. You have a lot of history with different viruses, whether it's the bad flu bugs, other bad bugs. Viruses come and go in terms of their the severity. So, for example, about every 5 years, there's a bad flu strain that comes, and it's worse than years prior. So we would expect the same thing with COVID, and we've seen the same thing with other bugs too.
Yeah.
And what that time frame looks like is sort of yet to be determined.
Yeah. It's almost as if the dust is still settling.
Yeah.
From all of that. And I can only imagine, you know, to the civilian scope, it'll settle much sooner than to the healthcare professional scope. Now, Rachel, what exactly is an occupational therapist?
Yes. With occupational therapy, we take a holistic approach when we're treating our clients. We look at occupation as anything one does throughout their day. So focusing on activities of daily living. So that might be helping someone relearn how to dress themselves after a stroke, or feed themselves, or bathing or toileting. And then we also look at those higher level ADLs, or activities of daily living, like meal prepping or medication management or driving. So we look at what deficits does someone have that's preventing them from being independent with those certain tasks, and that's what we focus on.
I know Sheridan Memorial Hospital really started pushing the idea that we don't want our patients to have to go anywhere but here after an intense surgery. We want to be able to take care of those right here. Were you part of that movement, or is occupational therapy a major component of that?
Occupational therapy is definitely a big component of the rehab process. And I'm fortunate I've been with the transitional care unit since this summer, and that has occupational therapy, physical therapy, and speech therapy. So we all work together as a team approach to getting someone back to their independence, their prior level of functioning. It's a great place for rehab. And there's also the outpatient through Wyoming Rehab also, and occupational therapy is involved there too.
What was that like once that unit was opened? And did you get the tour of the new office and get your new office? And I mean, what was it like going from, okay, I'm an occupational therapist, maybe I have an office kind of offset, but now we're bringing it all back in?
Yeah, I'm new to the transitional care unit. I just started this summer, and my family recently relocated to Sheridan. But I remember my first visit to the hospital and the transitional care unit, just the state-of-the-art rehab equipment they have. It's really impressive. The unit itself is a beautiful, well-thought-out place for rehab. I think to be part of that team is really awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something new here, which, I think is really going to help out a lot of people because we all know what a pain it can be. You get done with the surgery, you got to go out of town, you got to go to this doctor, but they're up here. That's a 2-hour drive, just a hassle. And sometimes it could be a painful one. What inspired you to start into occupational therapy?
My dad is a physician. He's a family doc, and my mom is a nurse. So I grew up within healthcare. I remember going on a home visit with my dad. I mean, this was a long time ago, and he would go to the nursing home to visit patients or to their home. And I love that. And then when I followed an occupational therapist within a hospital setting, I just fell in love with it. Knew right away that's what I wanted to do.
And what was training like?
For training, I did 4 years of college, and then it's a graduate degree. So it's a 2-year degree after college. And intense, but good. Definitely worth it.
Did they throw you through the gambit kind of like they do with our nurses?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
What's that the doctors have got to do? Like an internship.
Residency.
Residency. Yeah. And there are horror stories about residencies and the intensity of them, right?
That's correct.
Was yours pretty rough, Doc?
I wouldn't say it was too bad. Nothing like the stories from, 60s and 70s and 80s. It's a new... I guess it's a new age of medical training, and I'm sure it's the same with occupational therapy. It's different, but it was good and still intense, 80 hours a week consistently.
Ooh. Yeah. Ouch. A lot of coffee, I would imagine, during that time period. Now, Rachel, what would you say was the biggest challenge of your job daily if you were to wake up and say that I see this challenge a lot as an occupational therapist?
I think just not knowing the outcome with our patients. We all do the best we can and provide the best therapy and care that we can, but sometimes it's out of our hands, and that's hard. We want to see everyone succeed and return home and to being independent, and that's typically the goal, if that's the goal for the patient. And when that doesn't happen, that's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. You carry it with you, don't you?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Doc, I know I'm getting off in the weeds here, but how do you deal with situations like that as a medical professional? I imagine you guys suffer some deep emotional stress sometimes.
It's a delicate balance of compartmentalizing. You need to be emotionally invested enough to really provide the care that we need and want and that our patients need and want, but you can't be too invested to where it wrecks you and ruins your day or your life. And that's a fine balance, and it's a hard balance.
Yeah. You're needed. You got someone else in the waiting room. Yeah. All right, on that, we're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll have more with our Sheridan Memorial Hospital right after this. Stay with us. You're listening to Public Pulse on 930 KROE and 103.9 FM. Sheridan. Good morning and welcome back to Public Pulse. I'm your host, Floyd Whiting, and this morning we are speaking with Sheridan Memorial Hospital primary care physician, Dr. Christopher Schamber. I always put an L on there. Please excuse me. An occupational therapist, Rachel Fields. Now, Doc, you are a board-certified internal medicine doctor with a special interest in geriatric medicine and dementia. Brain change is so hard for individuals and families. It's nothing I've had to deal with extensively myself. But I've spoken with a lot of individuals on here who have. It is something that I try to get on the show as much as possible because it seems to be a growing problem. I've heard, and again, I'm going off in the weeds, I've heard theories that it's got something to do with possible cholesterol, all these other different things. I guess before I get too far into what I want to talk to you about today, is this problem becoming more frequent from your point of view?
I wouldn't say more frequent necessarily. It seems like that because the medical community in general is better and more comfortable at diagnosing it and, okay, and seeking out the evaluation. It's still such a nebulous diagnosis that we really don't have treatments for per se. And so in the past, the medical community shied away from diagnosing because it's always uncomfortable to say you have this bad diagnosis. We can't do anything about it. And it feels like just telling those patients, see you later. That's changing. We're screening for it like we would cancer. Diagnostic tests are up and coming and we're getting more and more of those. Our therapy colleagues are really instrumental in the diagnosis and care of these patients as well. So I would say it seems like it's more frequent just because the medical community is more adept at identifying it and formally diagnosing it.
And really leaning into it. Let's come up with new treatments. Let's try and address this situation. So it's getting more press time, really.
That's true. And before, I'm sure you've heard lots of people say, oh, that's just aging. That's just, this is just what happens when someone gets older. And what we know is that that's not the case. And so I think what people were seeing before as this is just aging was dementia. And again, for all the reasons I said before, it just wasn't called dementia or brain change or any other, term that you might have called
it. It's just grandpa. He's getting older.
That's right.
Right. And they're going to forget things. My father is 80 years old. All of his cognitive abilities are there and sharp as a knife. He's probably smarter now than he ever has been. So that is something that I've thought about in the past was why some, not others. And dementia, brain change, Alzheimer's, these are the causes.
Yeah, so it's a huge bag to unpack. Dementia is a broad term or a syndrome, if you will, with a bunch of different causes. Alzheimer's disease is one cause. Strokes are another cause. And there are a number of other different reasons for dementia. Alzheimer's disease, though, is easily the most common. 70 to 80% of patients with dementia, we believe, have Alzheimer's disease.
Wow. It's it happens more frequently than I thought it did. But I could see exactly where you're coming from on that because you didn't hear about it. Nobody talked about it as openly as we do now. Kind of like left-handers, right? When we stop forcing left-handers become right-handers, all of a sudden everyone felt that everybody was left-handed. Well, yeah, because I don't have to hide it anymore. Now, when it comes to driving, that is something I have experienced in the past. My grandmother on my mother's side had to be asked to kind of hang it up. That can be pretty tough conversation for a family to have. Driving is such a monumental step for individuals, especially in American culture. It's our first real sign into adulthood. It's independence. It's freedom. Can you tell me about this risk assessment that is being done? And is this being done down at the clinic, or is this up at Sheridan Memorial?
Well, I think it's important really quick to touch on the word that you used, that's independence. If you were to ask any older person what the most important thing in their life is, they would tell you independence. And they might not use that word, but that's what they're talking about is independence. And a huge part of that, as you pointed out, in our culture is driving. And I take it seriously in my job to maintain a patient's independence as long as possible. And that's independence in daily life, independence in their medical care, making their own decisions. But at some point, safety comes into play. And we're not only talking about that patient in front of us, but we're talking about the community as a whole. Where driving comes into play, if someone is not able to safely drive, that puts everyone at risk. And so we have to think about it in the terms of the community, really, in that respect. When we have patients that aren't safe to drive, we need to try and figure that out. And until now, we really haven't had the means to sort of objectively evaluate someone's driving risk.
Yeah.
And so that's where this program really comes into play. I've been talking about it over the last few years, and even dating back 5 or 6 years ago when Dementia Friendly Communities was a service through the hub and still continues to run through the hub. And certainly driving was a component of that, but we didn't have the means, again, to fully evaluate someone's driving risk. And then Rachel came on board with occupational therapy at the hospital and had some background in this and desire to get additional training in driver risk assessment, which just is the icing on that cake that we've been looking for quite a while.
Rachel, where does this interest in this come from? Before you came on board, you know, obviously something needs to be handled with sensitivity because you are, in a way, not you, but having an independence taken away from you. Where does your interest come from on that?
Prior to living in Wyoming, my family lived in Arizona, and I interviewed with the Phoenix VA. And during the interview, they asked if I had any interest in driver rehab. I had no background. It was never something that I had addressed as an OT working in inpatient rehab or skilled nursing facilities. We just didn't address driving. But I told them, of course, yeah, if they're willing to train, and I would love to do that. And I was with the VA for about 3 years. I worked in their driver rehab clinic, initially doing just the in-clinic assessments, which is similar to what we'll be offering here in Sheridan with the driving risk assessment. And then I went through their 2-week training to do become a driver rehab specialist and instructor. And after that training, I was able to do behind the wheel assessments and comprehensive driving evaluations. And I loved it. I felt like a big part of being an OT is helping someone gain independence, but also there's the other side of driving when it's time for driver retirement. How can we help someone do that gracefully and objectively providing input with that decision? And I'm so happy I get to continue with driver rehab and doing the driver risk assessment here in Sheridan.
So when the conversation was brought up, Doc, were you guys sitting around a table and you said, hey, I finally have somebody who's qualified to really look at this and give proper assessments? Or, I mean, was Rachel the key to getting this done?
She definitely was the key. I have been talking to the therapy department off and on over the past couple of years, and there was a recent patient that that we shared a few months ago, at least, that driving was a question mark, and different than dementia, it was even more complex, I would say, and it really addressed the need for this type of assessment. And we were going to have conversations with various community partners to include, you know, the police department and the sheriff's department, and trying to figure out how can we, you know, move forward as a community in this regard. And it turned out it was going to be really complex to try and do this. And there's, you know, discussion about a liability and who's the one that decides and all these things. And it ultimately always comes down to the doc in sort of certifying that driving risk or, you know, ability to drive, and we didn't have the ability. And then a few months after that last conversation, I got a call from Jeannie Brooks, the manager of the therapy department at Sheridan Memorial Hospital, and said, hey, we have this occupational therapist that has this interest in training, and she's going to get her certified, you know, credential. And it was that, again, like I said, the icing on the cake at the right time. It was perfect.
Yeah. Finally got the peg to fall into the right hole, and everything clicked. That's fantastic. Now, when it comes to the driving assessment, how are these done? Can you take me from beginning to end of a driving risk assessment?
Sure. With the driving risk assessment, we're doing an in-clinic assessment. With that, we're looking at one's medical history, their fall history, their insight into deficits. We also look at their current driving habits, and then we dive into the different aspects of driving. We break it down. We look at vision, physical abilities, that's strength, range of motion, brake reaction time, and the cognitive perceptual parts of driving. So there's assessments that we use that there are studies that show how they relate to driving. So that provides us those objective numbers and cutoffs, and we look at that full assessment and all those parts relate to one's driving ability, and then we can provide the primary care doctors a recommendation of one's risk, whether they're low risk with driving or high risk, and determine what are our next steps, where do we go from here.
And what are those options?
Sure. So the next steps, it might look like some continued therapy through Wyoming Rehab, possibly doing physical therapy or continued occupational therapy or speech therapy. And with Wyoming Rehab, we work as a team to maximize one's independence, and that someone might not need all three therapies, maybe one or even two. And we want to maximize one's potential. It also might look like we need to consider a comprehensive driving evaluation. So is that something that individual should pursue? Or are we looking at driving retirement at that time? And that's not a decision the therapy therapist makes, but it's something we provide to the doctor, and that's a decision they can talk with the family about and talk with the patient about and with that, you know, decision.
Doc, that's got to be tough. Being that individual who has to sign off on that, what do those conversations look like in the past?
Lots of anger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, it's removing that that one thing that's probably mostly associated with independence. It puts patients, especially those without close family or friends, it puts them in a difficult position.
Yeah.
Just simple things like getting groceries. It's always tough.
And you're right. Not all of us have family up here that I can just give a ring to and say, hey, Joe, take me to the store, or I need to go to my appointment, or anything like that. That's when things like Goose Creek become very viable and valuable to everybody in the community. Now, at what point or for what reason, and I'm sure there's many, should I come down and have either an assessment done on myself or try to get my dad, my mom to come on down?
Yeah, good question. I think for the most part, patients themselves are not going to identify the need for a driving risk assessment.
And they're be some stubborn people.
Yep, and they're not going to want to do that. Some of it is obvious after someone's had a stroke, for example, they're in the hospital, then they go to the transitional care unit or another rehab facility. And it's sort of obvious the need that might be there based on that specific diagnosis. When we're talking about dementia or brain change, which is a lot of what we're talking about really today, it really relies on family members. And that's how the patients come forward at this time. A family member comes with the patient and says, gosh, mom or dad just isn't driving well. They're running stoplights. They're getting lost. I would say, hate to put lists on things for patients or family members to have to say, yep, these are the things that should prompt this evaluation. I would say anything that seems not normal.
Yeah, not normal. Yeah. And that happens from time to time. And I've got stories of my own. Someone in my life underwent brain change and they didn't realize it. And boy, they went from being one of the sweetest people I've ever known in my life to being quite aggressive. And we found out later that a stroke had happened and nobody knew. And so these things can happen without knowing it, severe changes. And if they're getting lost more than once a week, 2-3 times a week maybe, or running those lights, becoming a safety hazard, then that conversation has to be done. It's always tough. Always tough. On that, I got to take another quick commercial break. We're going to have more with our Sheridan Memorial Hospital when we return. You're listening to Public Pulse on 930 KROE and 103.9 FM. Sheridan. Good morning and welcome back to Public Pulse, proudly brought to you by our friends out there at First Federal Bank and Trust. I'm Floyd Whiting, and this morning we're speaking with Sheridan Memorial Hospital primary care doctor Christopher Chambert and occupational therapist Rachel Fields. Now, the topic this morning is a driving risk assessment that can be conducted. Because brain change is it's very tough for patients. It's very tough for families. And driving is a sign of adulthood in America. One of the great initiations into adulthood, earning that license. That's your independence. And people sometimes have to hang it up. And that's always a tough conversation to have. There's now an assessment that can be done that can help us get there. Now, what if someone is on the cusps, the conversations about helping to rehabilitate someone who's maybe post-surgery or injury but could have some physical occupational therapy and be reevaluated for that risk? So if I go in one day and, boy, let's say I just bomb this assessment, could I say, hey, let me and Rachel spend some time together. Let me see if I can overcome these challenges. Is that an option?
Yeah, depending on one's medical history, there's definitely potential for improvement. With the driving risk assessment, it can be repeated if the improvement's made through therapy or medication changes. If someone's having difficulties with other aspects of their activities of daily living and they pursue occupational therapy or physical therapy or speech therapy to improve upon the deficits, then it might be appropriate to repeat that driving risk assessment and see where they're at after the therapy is completed.
And Rachel, you used a word in there that something that we haven't discussed, and that's medication. How many medications are out there where no heavy machinery, no operating a motor vehicle? And some of us have to take medication every single day of our lives. Some of that medication could be affecting the way that we drive. If I have to take a medication like this, and this is just a scenario, and I'm not sure it's going to really affect my driving or not, can I come in and take an assessment? Even if I'm a younger individual, 35 years old.
Typically in those situations, that would be a conversation with the doctor to talk about those side effects of the medication and how that could affect driving, or with time of day, something to be aware of with that medication and driving.
Gabapentin is often used for depression. It is that a narcotic, Doc? Is it considered a narcotic?
It's not considered
a narcotic. It's not considered, but it does make you a little loopy.
It can. Yeah, there are lots of medications out there. And mostly we're talking about medications that cause sleepiness or sedation, as we call it. And gabapentin is one of them. Sometimes antidepressants or anxiety medications, pain medications, even over-the-counter medications like Benadryl can do it.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, though, we talk about side effects. We say, hey, this can happen. So you need to be mindful. If it's one of the medications that are really risky, then we say, you've got to be on this for a couple of weeks. You need to not drive, you know, while you start it, and see how things go. Have, you know, have family members kind of go along with you and see how things are going. But if, generally speaking, those medications your body will get used to and you can go about your normal business.
You develop that tolerance in a way. Yeah. Okay. So, and I'm so glad that you brought that up, Rachel, medications, because so many of us nowadays have got something that we've got to take. Now, how do I set up an appointment if I need to get this assessment done, either for myself or for a loved one?
So you're going to need a primary care appointment. So whoever your primary care doc is, you're going to need an appointment with that person to get the referral initially. And then they can go through all of the other things that might be related to the driving risk, and that, you know, looking at things like dementia or brain change or stroke, and going through that, that process to try and identify a cause or medications that might be contributing or other things. Just like any other condition, if we're going to send somebody to an occupational therapist, for a hand problem, we want to have a diagnosis as much as we can, or at least rule out bad things or things that might affect what they do. And that's no different here. If we don't have enough information and we're sending somebody to Rachel early, it's probably inappropriate, and it's going to hinder her ability to be able to do the full assessment and therapy.
Okay, so know what we're dealing with before we have to deal with it. Right, Rachel?
Yes.
Now, all right. Now, I'm going to switch gears on you here real quick, Doc. I've only got about 5 or 10 minutes left with you. Now, Mrs. Fields, before I do switch gears, I just have a curiosity question.
Okay.
Within occupational therapy, you've seen patients recover from old injuries. If there was an injury that you deal with more than others here within our agricultural community, what would you say that is? Is it our backs or our knees that are going?
We do see a lot of backs, shoulders, knees, all things that, if appropriate, you know, therapy can help with.
Now, off the driving issue, maybe we've got a bad back, and we think, you know, a little work on this, I think I can get over it. I've been in that situation. So, and a little therapy did work. I'm feeling a lot better.
Good.
And my wife's always on top of me to do more. But I'd rather complain about the pain. So what do I need to do to get a hold of you? Maybe come see you in your office. So I need to go see my doc first?
Yes, that's correct. With therapy, we would need, even if it's not a driving related issue, you would need a referral from your primary doctor.
Okay. Doc, cold and flu season, it's not on us. It's right around the corner. Any tips?
wash your hands. Don't cough on other people. I know masks aren't, friendly in this community, but if you're sick and have to be out in the community and you're coughing, wearing a mask helps prevent you from getting other people sick. Stay at home if you're sick, if at all possible. Those things should really cover it.
You know, washing the hands, that's one thing. What is it, like upwards of 75% of illness, if not more, can be prevented with good, thorough hand washing? I've spoken with other doctors when it comes to the antibacterial soap thing. My wife has it at the house, but only for certain things. Where do you fall on that discussion? You're getting a smile on your face.
One of the first science experiments I remember doing in, it probably was sixth grade, seventh grade. We tested antibacterial soaps compared to non-antibacterial soaps. And it had no difference in the bugs. It was they were the same, and really? There have been scientific studies since that have shown that as well. That it's simply the hand washing that the scientific term is emulsification. It's the sudsing of the soap and the physical action of the soap and the rubbing that cleans the hands. So it's a marketing thing.
I knew it. No, I didn't know it. Actually, I was arguing with my wife, and she kept telling me one thing, and I was like, no, we need this soap. So, dang it, Doc, I was hoping to go the other direction. Once again, proving that the wife is right, I want to thank you both so much for coming in here and speaking with me this morning. It's an absolute pleasure seeing you again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
All right, you've been listening to Public Pulse on 930 KROE and 103.9 FM.